to apply or not to apply? Is DACA on or is it off? Wait, didn't the Supreme Court say it was on? The answers on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
And speaking about the Supreme Court, a refresher on voting by mail. Only the facts with PolitiFact. Also today, the story of two survivors of the Walmart killings in El Paso and their reunion almost a year to the day. Did you hear commissioners in Harris County are thinking about suing the state of Texas? And did you know the census and healthcare outcomes could be interconnected? Hear the clock. Tick-tock. It's Texas Standard Time. I am a lover of history. It's Wednesday, July 29th, and this is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. As I said, I am a lover of history, but I recently understood I am a creator of history, a reporter of history, and a witness to history and what historic moments we're living. From the national fight against a global pandemic to challenges educating children this fall and the continuing legal battle over DACA. You may remember DACA is the Obama-era program created to shield some young unauthorized immigrants from deportation. They are required to apply, and if approved, that gives them 2 years of protections. In June, the U.S. Supreme Court allowed the program to stand. But now, President Trump says DACA recipients should get 1 year instead of two, and that there shouldn't be any new applications. Julian Aguilar covers immigration and border security for the Texas Tribune, and he joins us now. Julian, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on.
Under the latest U.S. Supreme Court order, that kept DACA pretty much intact. My question to you is, what is the authority that the federal government is operating under to say we refuse to accept these applications and we're going to change the limit that the previous applications had?
Well, the people that are in favor of terminating the program, obviously including the Trump administration, they've argued that because it was put into play by an executive order that it could be rescinded just the same way, which is exactly what they tried to do in 2017. Almost 3 years ago now, the president sort of went back and forth on he was going to phase it out to give Congress time to act, and you know he was going to try to do it the right way and be compassionate. And fast forward almost 3 years later, and obviously Congress has not acted. The program was still in place. So what the Supreme Court ruled is that the administration didn't wind the program down correctly. They didn't mainly go to the public posting comment period as prescribed by federal procedure. So it's kind of a technicality, which is the irony is that the Administrative Procedures Act is exactly why the expanded DACA, the 2014 DAFA, was not allowed to go through. So this is something that people use quite often in courts. So what the president is saying is, like he said, the Supreme Court didn't hand us a loss. They didn't hand us a win. They just said, no, you have to come back or you have to try to wind it down another way. Mm. So this is the attempt that we saw going on Tuesday. But unless it's another executive order, which will likely go through the same court battles as DACA and DAPA did, without any legislation working through Congress, the chances are pretty slim that anything is going to happen.
I understand what you're saying in the sense of the Trump administration was not handed a win, it was not handed a loss. But nevertheless, this went through the whole process and arrived at the Supreme Court. Doesn't that matter to the Trump administration that there was a Supreme Court decision there?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, that's a lot of folks were saying, like, no, well, it should matter. But I think what also raised eyebrows yesterday was the fact that just earlier this month, not even 2 weeks ago, there was a separate federal court decision that said that the Trump administration must accept new applications. So Tuesday's announcement, was in definite violation of that. So this is going to be something that, again, will probably be challenged in the court system sometime soon. I would be surprised if there was an action filed on this front before the end of the week. And yeah, I mean, you raise a good question, but you know, a lot of folks that I spoke with yesterday, they said, look, we've seen the Trump administration do this with environmental waivers to construct the border fence, with transferring money to build the border fence, with, you know, kind of doing that the president has done. So, you know, Democrats are calling Trump lawless and, you know, with no respect for what the Supreme Court or what lawmakers do, the same way that Republicans accuse President Obama of doing the same thing when he and his executive action.
Absolutely.
So, of course, we're just a few months out from, you know, very important election. The president is going to try to do what he can to shore up, you know, folks that might be undecided, especially after we've seen what the polls have been looking like the last 2-3 weeks because of his response to the pandemic. And going back to the Supreme Court decision, you know, when people say, you know, well, how come the Dreamers are so happy if there wasn't a loss or a won? It's like, well, the Dreamers are very happy because the Supreme Court could have ruled just to end the program immediately. And they did the exact opposite.
With less than 4 months, I know that in a way you have alluded to everything is marked by the fact that we have a presidential election coming up in November. But it depends on the critic that you read. Some of them say, well, this is just, you know, political. Some of them say, well, this is because the Supreme Court did not say yay or nay. What do you see in the framework of we do have a presidential election coming up?
I think it's a way to send a message to his immigration hardline base saying, look, I tried to end the program. The Supreme Court said I did it the wrong way. So I came back and I excluded a large number of people from reapplying. I cut the benefits for renewals in half. So I am doing something. I think what was interesting in the longer memo that Acting Secretary Wolf sent out with respect to the details of Tuesday's announcement was there was a lot of language in there putting a lot of pressure on Congress. So that's also a play in an election year, right? I mean, presidents have done this for a long, long time, saying, look, I tried. I couldn't get it done. So don't blame me. Blame the House and the Senate for not being able to work and get legislation to my desk. So I think we're gonna see a ramp up in that language, sort of blaming the lower and upper chambers in Congress for not being able to get anything done.
We've been speaking with Julian Aguilar. He covers immigration and border security for the Texas Tribune. Julian, thank you so much.
Thank you, folks, for having me on. Have a great day.
It's been almost a year since the August 3rd mass shooting at an El Paso Walmart. It was the deadliest attack targeting Latinos in modern U.S. history. Alongside the horror of what happened that day, there were moments of heroism, shoppers risking their lives to help others escape from the gunmen. Today, KTEP's Angela Cocherga brings us the story of a recent reunion between an older gentleman and the woman who saved his life. Like many survivors, they hadn't seen each other since the attack.
After the car comes to a stop, Eduardo Castro, who goes by Eddie, is so eager to get out, he does not wait to get his walker out of the trunk. Castro's a legal resident of the U.S., but spends a lot of time in Ciudad Juarez with his wife. Last August 3rd, he'd crossed the border from Mexico, as he often does, to shop at the Cielo Vista Walmart. Today, though, he's come to an El Paso park to meet with 38-year-old Adria Gonzalez and her mother. Conversation flows easily in Spanish, Castro's preferred language. This is the first time he's seen the pair since last year's mass shooting. A hot summer breeze blows through the trees. They all wear masks and stand 6 feet apart, excited to see each other. Talk quickly turns to memories of that day and the moment when they heard the gunshots. When it started, Adria Gonzalez says she and her mother were debating which cut of beef to buy. Gonzalez quickly rushed from the meat department to the front of the store, ushering dozens of shoppers to the back as the gunmen advanced. Eddie Castro was in the produce department. When he heard Gonzalez yell, he ran. Castro's 72. Many of the shoppers that Saturday morning were older and had gone to Walmart to cash their monthly Social Security checks. More than half of the 23 people killed were over 60. The oldest was a 90-year-old man. Castro says he saw the shooter kill an elderly couple. If he had not followed Adria Gonzalez, he believes he would have ended up dead too. He calls Gonzalez an angel. For a moment, they forget COVID-19 precautions and embrace.
No se preocupe. No se preocupe.
Gonzalez's mother, 75-year-old Agueda Ponce Torres, quickly reminds them they must stand apart. She says she's not surprised her daughter flew to the aid of people during the shooting. Ponce Torres says a year later she still feels a lot of pain and mourns the lives cut short. All three say they're in therapy and are often on edge in stores. Castro says he still has trouble eating and sleeping. He rarely talks about the attack, but says this reunion was a chance to release pent-up emotions. Gonzalez agrees, switching to English to explain.
Yes, talking to him, it was just taking everything out and how we have the similar emotional situations and how we feel about it after that morning of August the 3rd. It's that connection we have between us. It's like I know him in another life.
She says saving Castro was like helping an abuelo, a grandfather, in this close-knit border community where many see each other as family.
We did it.
They survived. After promising to stay in touch, the trio walked through the park to their cars. Gonzalez and her mother will head to their homes in El Paso. Castro will make his way to the International Bridge, back to Juarez. Getting into his car, Castro calls out to the women. He asks God to bless and help them. In El Paso, I'm Angela Cocherga.
Oh, the beauty of human connection. But this is our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Welcome to the space, Wells.
Hi, Joy. Yes, what a powerful story we just heard. Yes, but in other news, UT Austin tops in a new college ranking, although it's not one worth bragging about. The campus tops the New York Times list of schools with the most COVID-19 cases since the spring, 449 out of the 6,300 cases the Times found among public four-year schools. Yes. On Facebook, Douglas Brown says, let's see what happens when UT classes begin in August. And Elise Maria notes, a full regular season of sports is scheduled. The stadium will be limited to 50% capacity, but suites and tailgates won't. Just one of the stories we're eyeing. Lots more news about coronavirus in schools. I'll be back with those stories later in the show.
Yes, reach out on social media. Wells Dunbar will find you. You're on Texas Standard Time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. Harris County is heading for a collision with the Texas Attorney General over school reopenings in the face of COVID-19. And Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports that commissioners have opened the door to a lawsuit against the state.
The move comes after Attorney General Ken Paxton issued guidance saying that counties, including Harris County, do not have the authority to close schools as a preemptive measure. Commissioner Adrian Garcia wrote a resolution affirming the county's order to keep schools closed through at least September 8th.
And authorizes the county attorney to take whatever action necessary to protect the local health authority's supervisory authority and control over the administration of communicable disease control measures within its jurisdiction necessary to protect the public health and contest any opposition by the state of Texas to that supervisory authority.
The vote authorizing the potential lawsuit was 3-2 along party lines. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. The 2020 census deadline has been extended to the end of October, but certain areas in Texas still have a very low response rate. Dominic Anthony Walsh with Texas Public Radio's Petri Dish podcast reports on how undercounted populations and unprepared healthcare systems collide during a pandemic.
The census has happened every 10 years since 1790. This 1940s film is from the Bureau of the Census's archives. It's a very patriotic promo for the census and for America in general.
It's more than 130 million free people. It's 33 million homes. It's 7 million farms. It's vast panorama of other resources.
All of those numbers, they come from the census. But it's not like the census is just an exercise in counting. It's about money and power. Money for education, infrastructure, and healthcare, and power in the form of congressional seats and electoral votes. Ideally, the appropriation and apportionment processes are based in reality.
Unbiased facts to measure markets for business and the farmer, the plans of school and health officials, the needs of local governments.
But the census, historically, has failed to capture the true reality in certain parts of the country.
For you cannot know your country unless your country knows you.
We're in Willacy County, the least populated in the Rio Grande Valley. Frank Torres is the county's emergency management coordinator.
We're a rural community. We have no hospitals in our community.
And no public hospitals in the entire valley, period. They're all private and they're all overwhelmed.
We're having to deal with 6 to 12 hour waits at the emergency room with our patients.
And right now, Willacy County's census response rate is less than 40%.
Whenever we apply for any federal funding, if only 40% of the population reported themselves in the census, then we're only going to get 40% of the funding that we're due.
So the west of Willacy County is Hidalgo County, the most populated area in the valley. The response rate here is about 47%, better than the rest of the valley, but still 10 points below the state average and 15 points below the national average. Local officials believe Hidalgo County was undercounted by at least 25,000 people in 2010, so they've stepped up outreach efforts. So I just pulled over to the side of the road on 10th Street, headed north. Just before it intersects with Interstate 2, the southernmost interstate highway in the country, across the four-lane road, I can actually see a Border Patrol pickup truck going through the drive-thru of a Starbucks. And, right next to the Border Patrol truck, kind of extending over this four-lane street, there's a banner. It says, Censo se contado, Census 2020, be counted.
Okay, I really need that document.
Is this? I think this is it.
We're at the Incident Command Center for Doctors Hospital at Renaissance in Edinburgh, the county seat of Hidalgo. Carlos Cardenas is the chairman of the hospital's board. The hospital ran short on critical equipment early in the pandemic.
We had very few, relatively few, N95 masks, for example, so we became very creative.
The staff sewed masks, which are still in use. Cardenas says they're quality masks, but they aren't N95s. Those are expensive. Stockpiling PPE and other equipment for a pandemic is very expensive. An accurate population count and the federal funding that comes with it could have offset some of that expense.
In the Rio Grande Valley, it was estimated that in 2010 that we were undercounted by about 300,000 people. The Rio Grande Valley, if it were accurately counted, could gain as much as $473 million annually, or $4.7 billion over the next 10 years.
During our interview, President Trump released a memo calling for the exclusion of unauthorized immigrants from the apportionment process. It's already in court.
So if you're undocumented or documented, it doesn't matter if your child fell and hit their head and needs emergency services. We're here to take care of those people. And so in order to be able to have the appropriate funds for a particular area, you need to know what your population is, documented or not.
This memo is reminiscent of earlier drama around the census, the citizenship question. It was rejected by the Supreme Court, but there's still a lot of fear in the community. Maria is an unauthorized immigrant in the valley. She asks that TPR only use her first name.
Si nos ayuda en que pueden dar saber cuántos niños hay en casa, en ayudar para las escuelas, sí. Para programas.
She says she filled out the census because she wants schools to be funded, but she understands the fear.
Pero pues, ¿quién puede decir que no pueden de repente deportar a alguien?
She says someone might fill out the census, then see a family member deported. And that coincidence, that's how a rumor starts.
I mean, there's a lot of deportations, and so people are worried about deportations and being deported. But I think that the important thing to remember is that doing the census is totally separate from any of that.
Lewis Brown is an associate professor at University of Texas Health School of Public Health in El Paso, another region where response rates are, historically, low. Brown and his colleagues partner with community organizers to reach out to undercounted communities. All the news and rhetoric around the census has a chilling effect on response rates.
Yeah, it does. I think the Trump administration has done a number of actions to make this harder and to make an undercount more likely.
Trump's rhetoric has increased fears that the census will be used to begin deportations. Public health professionals and local officials had a lot of plans to address these fears directly, in-person events, community outreach, and then a pandemic hit.
It's made it harder for sure.
With the extended October deadline approaching, the Valley's response rate is still below 50%, and there's a lot of money at stake.
Earlier, I mentioned the billions of dollars that gets distributed. If you think about it on a per person basis, it works out to about $2,000 per person per year. And since the census will be used over 10 years, that's $20,000 per person that's at stake here.
And that's in normal times. Right now, trillions of dollars are flying around. Without an accurate population count, the Valley is again being shorted on these relief bills, even though it's one of the hardest hit areas in the country. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in McAllen, Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A U.S. House subcommittee is hearing testimony on Fort Hood's response to sexual misconduct following Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen's murder at the base in April. California Democrat Jackie Speier opened the hearing, saying thousands of service members and veterans have come forward since Guillen's death with their own accounts of harassment and assault.
For too long, they have lived and suffered in silence. Silenced by a culture that doesn't trust women, that questions their competence, that is suspicious of their motives, that perceives them as weak and unreliable.
An Army Inspector General investigation found most Fort Hood personnel met overall standards for reporting sexual misconduct, but findings on Guillen's unit have not been released. President Donald Trump is visiting the Permian Basin today. Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borden reports the president will discuss the future of the region's energy industry.
Trump is arriving in Midland to take a firsthand look at the Permian Basin's oil industry and raise money for his reelection. The president is slated to have lunch in Odessa, where guests will need to pay $2,800 to attend. Other supporters looking to sit with the president during a roundtable discussion will need to shell out $100,000 for a seat. The president is scheduled to stop at an oil rig where he will give remarks focused on returning energy dominance to the Permian Basin. Tom Craddock, Midland state representative, told the Midland Reporter-Telegram that the president plans to cut regulations and increase incentives for oil companies. I'm Mitch Borden in Midland.
A new report from a progressive organization finds media in the state have largely lacked diverse sources for political analysis during the 2020 election cycle. Progress Texas examined experts quoted on the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate between last November and March using media tracking software and manual sorting to identify 416 unique news articles. 72% of the political sources in those stories were men, and nearly three-fourths were white. Political sources include professors, legislators, consultants, and activists. Diana Gomez is the group's advocacy manager.
Texas is a diverse state, and Texans deserve to see diverse viewpoints and backgrounds represented in the news that they consume every day.
Gomez says Progress Texas is encouraging journalists to include more people of color, women, and LGBTQ individuals in their political coverage. And the University of Texas at Austin has more confirmed cases of COVID-19 than any other four-year college in the U.S. with 449. That's according to a New York Times analysis. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron, Adler, Clough, and Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're on Texas Standard Time. I'm Joy DSN for David Brown. A public health directive issued in March has accelerated the removal of thousands of unauthorized migrants from the U.S. border with Mexico. Thousands of people have been expelled to Mexico since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, and these stepped-up removals include asylum seekers, who advocates argue have been illegally shut out of the asylum process. So as part of our series on these Title 42 expulsions, KRA's Mallory Falk has the story of two families expelled from El Paso to Ciudad Juarez.
It all happened so fast. An asylum seeker from Guatemala crossed the U.S.-Mexico border with her two young daughters in April. She says they turned themselves in to Border Patrol.
Nos agarraron a nosotros.
The woman, who asked us not to use her name out of fear for her safety, says officials grabbed them and said, "We're going to take you back to Mexico." They told her they weren't letting anyone into the U.S. They dropped her and her daughters on an international bridge around 3 a.m. She sat down near the base of the bridge and wrapped her younger daughter in a warm jacket, protection against the nighttime chill. Around the same time, Juarez-based immigration lawyer Tanya Guerrero started noticing something strange.
We started seeing a few people come back from the United States without any documentation, and they were being returned through Santa Fe Bridge at really odd hours, very, very late at night, in the middle of the night.
In the year before, asylum seekers sent back to Mexico were placed in the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, and given paperwork with U.S. immigration court dates. What these people described was different.
They have been basically pushed away from the United States with no process whatsoever.
Like the mother I spoke with and her daughters, and this woman.
Hola, buenos días.
From El Salvador, who also asked us not to use her name out of safety concerns. She says she arrived at the border just 10 days after the CDC order went into effect. She recounts her story over video chat from a government-run shelter in Juarez. Her 4-year-old daughter pops in and out of the screen.
Yo decidí salir de mi país porque fui amenazada de muerte por el papá de mi hija.
The woman says they fled from El Salvador when an abusive ex-partner, the girl's father, threatened to kill her. By the time she arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border, it was effectively closed. She says she was apprehended soon after crossing into Texas. Officials took her picture and fingerprints and asked for identification. Then the family was taken to an international bridge. She says they didn't explain what was happening, just told her she had to leave the U.S. She says she begged officials, told them she couldn't go back to her home country, or Mexico. The officials, she claims, said they didn't care what happened to her or where she went, but she wasn't getting into the U.S. She says they threatened to press charges if she refused to leave the bridge. She left with her daughter and connected with Mexican officials who convinced a shelter to take her in, a place called the Leona Vicario Migrant Integration Center. The shelter, run by the Mexican government, opened last summer to house asylum seekers and MPP. It's been on lockdown since March, but it's still taken in a few people. Tanya Guerrero, the immigration attorney, worries some people won't make it to shelters. They're mostly left to their own devices, she says, and can fall through the cracks. But she's been able to provide some legal consultations.
And I think the first question to always answer is, what happened to me? They have no idea what happened. Everyone explains it to be extremely fast and that they're not able to express their fears.
That's a big deal because it means they don't have an opportunity to seek asylum. we asked Customs and Border Protection how they determine whether someone is granted a credible fear interview, the first step in the asylum process, and if that's changed since the CDC order went into effect. A CBP spokesperson replied, quote, "These instances are handled on a case-by-case basis." The mother from Guatemala, who was dropped off on a bridge at 3 in the morning, she ended up at the Leona Vicario shelter, too. The last time we talked, there was a COVID outbreak at the shelter. At the time, 12 people had tested positive and been placed in isolation. She told me she was ready to leave and hoped to catch a bus back to Guatemala with her two daughters. I don't know if they'll let us in, she says, but we want to leave. Others still hope to find a way into the U.S., even if they don't know when or how that might happen. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
You may remember this story is the second installment in a four-part series on the rapid expulsions happening along the U.S.-Mexico border. You can hear more at texasstandard.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
This is Moises Chiuyan, and you're listening to the Texas Standard. Camp Half-Blood, Austin Branch, is a camp for demigods of ages 9 to 18, where kids get to participate in the same kinds of activities that they find in the Percy Jackson books. With everything going on in the world, Camp Half-Blood has gone fully online, and that includes going on quests every day. And that is something I am part of in my role as assistant to the regional monstrologist. Instead of dividing them up in cabins based on godly parent, which is typically the way that camp does that, they've been organized into smaller class sizes, as it were, though we've been trying to stay away from online school because online school is a very sore subject for all of these kids and all of their parents. They get to go through the week, go on the different rotations, whether it's Roman hand-to-hand combat, sword training, we have arts and crafts, we have music, and those of us who are in the field going on quests, we all wear PPE of some sort. We do safe physical distancing. The quests can vary in intensity. Sometimes they're very scary. Sometimes suddenly we find ourselves completely in the dark. Different monsters have different abilities. When we encounter a Gorgon, we have to have the kids direct us using a mirror so that we aren't turned to stone. Sometimes a quest can be as simple as to appease a given monster. We have to cook it a steak, and so we cook the monster a steak. Or we bring them some of the finest Central Texas brisket, or a taco, or something like that. When I am on location, I tend to use balaclavas that are made of something called ice silk. So when you're out in the heat, you have the benefit of breathable masking that, as long as you're physical distancing enough, you're getting the masking benefit from it. And you also have the cooling benefit of it from having dunked it in some ice cold water, because it's July and it's only going to keep getting hotter. And then I also use a terry cotton fabric mask that I've been getting 3-packs of from Los Angeles Apparel out in California. We've mandated that good guys wear masks and bad guys don't. Camp Half-Blood Austin, we finish up the first week of August with our 10th session. Hopefully, if we have enough young demigods, young heroes out there to help us, we may be able to push back the efforts of the Mayan god of the underworld. But it's going to be entirely up to whether we can summon the strength of the young minds and young hearts that we need. This is Moises Chiuyan, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
We want to hear your story in our Tell Me About Your Mask segment, and we're trying to record a bit of this moment in Texas history when we were all required to wear face coverings. So do you have a mask that matches your pairs of shoes, or do you find it hard to communicate with your mask on? Reach out on social media or send us an email at texasstandard@kut.org. Houston has a brand new medical school, and Monday was the first day of classes. The University of Houston College of Medicine takes a new approach to solving an old issue in Texas, which is the lack of primary care physicians in underserved areas. And it's an issue that's taken on even more importance during a pandemic that has disproportionately affected people of color. Houston Public Media's Sarah Willa Ernst talked with students getting ready for their first day.
It's orientation week for first-year med student Brianna Sashery. She's making herself a bagel and a cup of tea, some fuel for the day, before logging into Zoom where most of her classes will be for the time being. 3 weeks ago, Brianna drove more than 1,800 miles from Boston, where she went to graduate school, back to her home state of Texas to start med school.
This is my community, and it felt very natural for me to come home to study medicine in the place where I ultimately hope to practice.
This is an ambition many of the 30 students in the inaugural class share. The group is mostly first-generation college students, overwhelmingly Black and Hispanic, and all of them have roots in Texas. Brianna, she grew up in Alvin, Texas, just south of Houston.
I grew up in a family that had a lot of issues and prevalence of chronic diseases.
She and some of her classmates have experienced the state's gap in healthcare firsthand.
I definitely grew up in a medically underserved city, and so that often meant that we had to travel outside of Alvin to get the medical care, quality care, I would call it, that we needed.
Texas in general has a shortage of doctors, but it's especially bad for primary care physicians. According to the United Health Foundation, the number of these kinds of doctors is 29% below the national average, and Texas ranks 45th out of 50 states when it comes to access. In Harris County, although access is better than most other parts of the state, it still lags behind the rest of the country.
And we live in a city with the greatest medical center in the world, and yet if you look at our health statistics, you know, in certain geographic communities, we have major health disparities, significant poor health. In some cases, our health are similar to the developing world.
Dr. Steven Spann is the founding dean of the UH College of Medicine. He says primary care access is a crucial component to improving the rate of chronic disease and mortality in underserved communities.
Primary care doctors have a real focus on prevention. Secondly, it's sort of one-stop shopping. You can get most of your health care needs at one physician, and they typically do a really good job of managing chronic diseases.
Projections from the state show the shortage in East Texas is going to get worse in the next 10 years as the population continues to grow. The new medical school is one way to keep up with the growing medical demand.
Most medical schools in this country don't emphasize primary care.
Dr. Spann says primary care is often seen as less prestigious and lucrative than a career as a specialist. And UH is trying to overcome these challenges by offering scholarships and crafting a particular culture.
It will be absolutely against the rules for any faculty to ever say to a student, you're too smart to be a primary care doctor. That will not happen.
And in this program, primary care is baked into the curriculum. For all 4 years, students will spend half a day every week working in a primary care clinic. They'll also go with social workers each month to do home visits with patients in the Third Ward and East End. Serving Black and Hispanic communities with unequal access to healthcare is what drew many students to apply to the program in the first place. But for Brianna, during a year marked by the COVID-19 pandemic and national protests in the name of racial justice, that feels even more true now that she's actually here.
It feels very surreal to be starting medical school right now.
Brianna says she wants to use her degree to do more than just practice medicine, but also to advocate for patients on the policy level and build trust between the medical community and Black Americans. Because she believes good health doesn't just mean healing the body, but healing relationships too. I'm Sarah Willa Ernst in Houston.
The National Women's Soccer League is the first U.S. sporting league to resume competition during the COVID pandemic, and a Texas team has been crowned the champion. The Houston Dash won the NWSL Challenge Cup in Utah this week, their first title since the team's founding in 2013. The Dash beat Chicago Red Stars 2-0 in the final game held on Sunday. It was not the favorite team going in. 538 had it at the bottom of the pack with only a 7% chance of taking home the title. They'll hold a drive-in parade for fans celebrating the big win on Thursday at the BBVA Stadium in Houston.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town while keeping safety in mind. Shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions like Moody Gardens and more. Details at galveston.com.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. Viral social media posts on Facebook say that the U.S. Supreme Court recently ruled there would be no voting by mail. But is that a fact? Here to help sort it all out is Madeline Meckelberg. She joins us each week from PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, so good to speak with you again.
It's great to talk with you.
Can you give me the background on this particular claim? I'm thinking that it's related to the issue of how to handle voting in the middle of a pandemic. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. There have been a ton of conversations, a ton of lawsuits over this issue. The main question being whether everyone should be allowed to vote by mail during an election if they're concerned about contracting the virus at the polls. And that means everyone, not just those who are normally allowed to vote by mail during an election. And given all these questions that we have, there was a lot of uncertainty going into the primary runoff elections in Texas, which were on July 14th. And even still looking ahead to the November election, there's a lot we don't know about what's actually going to be allowed. And this confusion manifested, as it usually does, in a questionable social media post, like with the one we're going to talk about today. Mm-hmm. It had a lot of exclamation points and capital letters, and it said, "If you haven't already heard, the Supreme Court ruled today, no voting by mail."
So one question that I have for you is the post suggesting that the Supreme Court says that people who were previously allowed to vote by mail can no longer vote by mail? Is it suggesting that everyone has to vote in person at the polls? What are we talking about?
I think that's a great question, and it's important to say beyond Texas, nationally, there are 5 states that regularly have universal vote-by-mail elections, and there are 12 states that allow their counties to opt in to mail-in voting or have it for some elections, but not others. But in Texas, our laws are pretty strict about who's allowed to mail in a ballot during elections, and those are people who are over 65, those who are disabled, those who will be out of the county on election day, and those in jail who are otherwise eligible to vote. And all of those individuals have to apply to request an absentee ballot in order to file through the mail for the election. Now, the court case that this post is talking about mm-hmm. would not affect those people who are already allowed by state law to vote by mail. It's just about the question of whether that right should be expanded to all voters in the state.
Okay, can you talk a little bit more about the case? What case is that? The specific case that the post is talking about?
So this is a case that originated in Texas. It's one of many lawsuits that the Democratic Party here filed ahead of the runoff elections on July 14th. And one of the cases filed in federal court made its way all the way to the Supreme Court, and they rejected the Democrats' request to approve an emergency motion that would have expanded mail-in voting to everyone during the runoff election. But what's important here is that the court was acting on an emergency request, and they denied that request, but they didn't rule or speak to the merits of the case itself. So the case is still pending. So things could change between now and the November election. And there are multiple lawsuits, including at the state level, that could change the reality for voters come November.
I love all that detail. So ruling on the claim that the Supreme Court ruled today, as you said, uppercase, exclamation points, no voting by mail. What did PolitiFact rate this?
So that's not accurate. People who could always vote by mail still can. And the court's decision was really targeted to a logistical choice in this case. And it was not about the merits of the case. So we rated this claim false.
False. False is the ruling from the fact checkers at PolitiFact, and Madeline Meckelberg heads up PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard.
Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, he's back. Hey, Wells.
Hey, Joy. Good to be back with you.
Yeah.
After a non-binding opinion from Texas AG Ken Paxton, the Texas Education Agency now says it will not fund school districts that keep classrooms closed due to local health mandates.
We
heard about this earlier
in
the show. Exactly. Quite the roller coaster. And that's being reflected on some of the comments we're hearing on social media. We got this tweet from a one Snatch Bandicoot 2 weeks ago. They said they wouldn't lose funding, and now that's changed. Aaron Curley Hatfield also tweets us. She writes, "This decision will directly contribute to the illness and deaths of students and school staff. I hope the TEA, Texas Education Agency, understands that." And seeing a lot of tweets and messages on Facebook like this one from Tex in China. She says, "Seriously, I'm tired of my profession being used as a political game piece. And I know that some parents are very eager for in-person school options. I know, and I know you do too, Joy."
We do have children at home.
Definitely.
But you know what?
So.
I also in another life was a teacher, and I can understand the frustration of the teachers with, you know, one day they tell you one thing, the next day they tell you another thing. And it's not like, it's kind of like realigning a train.
Right.
You know, and I read a tweet that really hit me because this teacher said, "Stop using us," you know, and he even said, "This is cruelty, the way you guys are treating us."
Yeah.
And, you know, I can feel
seeing
him.
Similar
yeah.
things and seeing similar, you know, tweets and messages from parents who feel like their children are these political pawns in this sort of back and forth. And just a lot of dimensions to this. And again, I've seen some calls here on Twitter for some more clarity from the governor, who's really sort of thread the needle on a lot of these decisions. Benjamin Chow tweets us that Governor Abbott is like a leaf blowing in the wind. One day he mandates masks, the next he forces schools to open. That said, I should walk that back a little bit because his guidance on this is unclear. And, you know, I think we're going to see some legislation on this. I wouldn't be surprised if that happens before.
Nothing surprises us anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Or lawsuit, rather, instead of legislation.
I see. Uh-huh.
Lawsuit.
Yeah.
Also calling back to this, actually, we haven't mentioned this yet, but we should touch on this. President Donald Trump touching down in Midland today.
Yes.
One Texas politico that won't be in attendance, Louie Gohmert. That's
Tell
because
us
the
why.
Northeast Texas representative and Congress staunch anti-mask conservative has been diagnosed with COVID-19.
Oh, my God.
Yes, very interesting news. NPR reporting that members of the House Judiciary Committee were informed that Gohmert tested positive for the coronavirus. He was just on Capitol Hill yesterday with Attorney General William Barr wearing no mask whatsoever. A wild turn of events. Maybe not entirely unsurprising since he has, you know, refused to wear a mask in public. He's, you know, vociferously called into question the merits of these, you know, mask mandates in states like Texas and across the country.
You know what news I've been focusing on, Wells?
What's that?
Well, of course, the Friday deadline on the unemployment benefits and having no agreement yet. But the other one that I've been thinking about is that, you know, the presumed Democratic presidential contender, Joe Biden, they're expecting that he will announce who is his running mate by next
week.
And I wonder if it could be a Texan. Maybe not, but you know.
I guess
I
we'll
wonder.
Just have to wait and see. Are
they,
you announcing something, Joy?
Say,
is that what you're saying?
Have they called you, Wells? Hey, let's do this again tomorrow. This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. Thanks for listening.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, sharing that regular screenings like mammograms and colonoscopies are essential preventative appointments. Early detection of cancer often leads to better outcomes. More at TexasOncology.com. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.